This is the Electronic Intifada Newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 776 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. In Gaza, Israel has continued to routinely kill and injure Palestinians in spite of the October 10th so-called ceasefire, while desperately needed humanitarian aid, including shelter materials, medicine, basic food items, and supplies for infrastructure repair, remain blocked, entrenching multiple catastrophes for Palestinians as the winter rains come. Israel's destruction of houses and buildings across the vague and invisible so-called yellow line has been ongoing, posing threats for Palestinians trying to return to their homes and property. Reporter Ibrahim Al-Salut filmed, quote, continuous gunfire accompanied by the sounds of explosions amid ongoing Israeli violations of the ceasefire agreement in areas east of Khan Yunis on Tuesday. On Wednesday, Israel conducted a series of airstrikes on multiple locations across Gaza. At least 32 Palestinians were killed, including 12 children, according to the health ministry. The attacks targeted Palestinian men, women, and children in tents and crowded shelters in the Zeytun and Shujaiya neighborhoods of Gaza City. Reporter Faiz Osama posted this video to social media in the aftermath of an Israeli drone attack on a building housing displaced people in Shujaiya, which killed at least 6 people. The spokesperson for the Gaza Civil Defense, Mahmoud Bassal, was filmed by reporter Nahed Hajjaj at Al-Shifa Hospital on Wednesday as he held up the dead body of a little girl. Bassal said, quote, when will these scenes end in Gaza? When will the scenes of our children being murdered end? How long will the scenes of murdering children in Gaza continue? These are our children being killed. What was their crime? Why do they get killed? Why are those who are preparing to sleep in the cold being killed? They were preparing to sleep in their mother's embrace, but they were killed. Israel killed them.
لماذا يقتل هؤلاء الذين تحضروا لأن يناموا في برد خارس؟ أرادوا أن يناموا بحضن أمهم لكنهم قتلوا.
Mahmoud Bassal of the Civil Defense in Gaza. Al Jazeera reporter Hani Mahmoud stated that, quote, all of a sudden sounds of explosions, the presence of the drones in the skies, fighter jets that patrol the central and the eastern part of the Gaza Strip, were all indications that this was a military campaign. In Khan Yunis, Israeli attacks targeted a group of people inside a UN building, killing at least 3 and injuring others. In addition to the dozens of Palestinians killed on Wednesday, the health ministry said that at least 77 were injured in the series of air raids and tank shellings. On Tuesday, November 18th, a Palestinian was killed by Israeli sniper fire east of the Bureij refugee camp in central Gaza, according to Al Jazeera. The attack took place in the so-called safe zone beyond the yellow line, where Israel maintains military control. A similar attack happened on Monday when Israel killed 2 Palestinians, accusing them of crossing the so-called yellow line and posing a threat to Israeli forces. That same day, Israeli drones fired on a school sheltering displaced families in the Daraj neighborhood of Gaza City. Reporter Ahmed Al-Najjar said that at least 10 Palestinians were wounded in the attack, quote, during a ceasefire that never ceased Israel's fires. The Gaza government media office stated on Wednesday, before the series of attacks on Gaza City and Khan Yunis, that since the ceasefire agreement on October 10th, Israel had committed 393 violations, resulting in the deaths of 279 Palestinians and 652 injured. The deaths, injuries, and abductions of at least 35 Palestinians, the media office noted, quote, underscores the occupation's determination to undermine the agreement and create a bloody reality on the ground that threatens security and stability in the Gaza Strip. The Israeli occupation's attacks, the office added, have included 113 direct shooting incidents targeting civilians, homes, residential neighborhoods, and displaced persons' tents, 17 incursions by occupation vehicles into residential and agricultural areas, crossing the temporary yellow line, 174 shelling and bombardment operations by land, air, and artillery, and 85 demolitions of homes and civilian infrastructure. This systematic crime aims to expand destruction and collectively punish the population, constituting a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions, the media office said. Euromed Human Rights Monitor stated on November 10th that the continued massacres, attacks, destruction of homes, property, and land, continued prevention of the entry of food, humanitarian aid, and basic infrastructure materials are not isolated incidents, but, quote, part of a systematic pattern indicating a clear policy by the Israeli political and military leadership to use the ceasefire as a cover to continue genocide against Gaza's residents. By maintaining a disguised military assault and perpetuating killing, starvation, and systematic destruction, Israel exploits the absence of international will to protect civilians and hold perpetrators accountable. The human rights group warned, quote, of a grave development, the dismantling of the Gaza Strip's geographical unity, turning it into an isolated and uninhabitable area. This risks entrenching a permanent geographical and demographic division and pushing the population toward forced displacement as the only means of survival. Winter rains and flooding have exacerbated the humanitarian and health crises across Gaza this week. Beginning on November 14th, more than 18,000 households in Gaza were affected by the rain and floods, according to the UN. Quote, thousands lost their shelters, had their belongings damaged, or were again displaced. This number continues to increase as partners complete additional assessments to gauge the extent of the damage caused by the storm, the UN said. The Gaza government media office stated on November 17th that people are facing their third winter since the genocide began, quote, without protection. The Gaza Strip is witnessing an unprecedented humanitarian catastrophe, with more than 288,000 Palestinian families living through a harsh ordeal amidst severe weather conditions and a complete absence of the minimum requirements for survival, the media office noted. Quote, what we have repeatedly warned against has become a painful reality. Tens of thousands of tents sheltering hundreds of thousands of displaced people were flooded with the first storm of this winter. A scene that embodies the scale of the suffering and the international community's failure to provide adequate shelter. We have clearly stated that the Gaza Strip needs 300,000 tents and mobile homes to ensure basic human shelter, yet the world has not acted as required. The office stated that the Israelis have continued to also prevent the entry of flooring materials to protect the bottoms of tents and blankets, mattresses, and thermal insulation materials, as well as mobile health clinics with water and sanitation services and lighting and alternative energy supplies. Since October 10th, at least 9 attempts by the United Nations and its partners to bring in tents have been rejected, the UN Humanitarian Office stated on Monday. The international charity Save the Children stated on November 18th that, quote, children in Gaza are sleeping on the bare ground with no shelter in flimsy shorts and t-shirts that are sodden with sewage water after their tents flooded in a weekend of heavy rains, putting them at risk of disease. The media manager at Save the Children in Gaza said that on November 14th, quote, people woke up and found themselves submerged in sewage water. We've had 2 years of living in tents, and they are already worn out. They cannot withstand the wind or the rain. I saw a woman with a six-month-old baby carrying her, running around, screaming, "Where shall I go?" According to data from the shelter cluster of aid organizations in Gaza, more than two-thirds of Gaza's children, about 700,000, are exposed to similar risks, living in tents that are falling apart after 2 years of bombardment and displacement, Save the Children added. And since the announcement of the first phase of the so-called ceasefire agreement in October, more than 63,000 tents, 803,000 tarpaulins and 278,000 bedding kits remain stuck at the boundary crossings. The Israelis have also banned the entry of timber and tool kits due to restrictions on what Israeli authorities consider dual-use items, the agency said. Quote, without tools and equipment, people are unable to start repairs to homes and many are scared to move due to unexploded ordnance, already causing child casualties or the fear of further airstrikes. Most people are still sheltering in whatever is left of tents used over the past 2 years, sewing blankets or any other materials they can find to patch up holes, Save the Children stated. And despite seeing more items in the markets, blankets, mattresses, and new clothing are almost nowhere to be found. And children are still wearing summer clothes, like shorts and t-shirts, most of them barefoot. Quote, with families desperate for the basics to survive, they spend what little they have on food rather than new clothes, the group said. Dozens of Palestinian medical patients who were receiving treatment in hospitals in occupied Jerusalem returned to Gaza this week through the Kerem Abu Salem or Kerem Shalom crossing. Our contributor Donya Abu Sitta recorded this video of families awaiting their loved ones who traveled on buses arriving in Khan Yunis. Amid the joy and relief of their families, these patients come back to a landscape of utter destruction and a collapsed healthcare system with limited access to basic medication and treatments. Donya sent us this short report by voice message on Wednesday.
Imagine leaving your home for just a few days to seek medical treatment, only to be separated from your family for 2 years. While you are away, they live under bombing and fire, moving from one tent to another, facing hunger, fear, and genocide. This is not fiction. It's the reality of dozens, perhaps hundreds of families from Gaza who left for treatment in hospitals in the West Bank before the war began. Then the border closed, and they become watching the news with a broken heart. On last Monday, I was studying by the light of my laptop screen, as we do in Gaza, since electricity has been cut off for 2 years. When I heard loud cheering from Nasser Hospital, I stepped out into the window and saw a crowd joyfully chanting. I thought it were welcoming home released prisoners, but the surprise came the next day. They weren't prisoners. They were patients who had finally returned to Gaza after 2 years of celebration, pain, and waiting. Imagine returning to your city, which you left carrying only the pain of your illnesses, and finding it only rubble. Imagine looking for your home and finding nothing. Look for your sibling, but not seeing them. Searching for your mother and finding her buried under the rubble. These stories are not exception. They are chapters in ongoing tragedy. Their story deserves to be written, read, and heard.
Our contributor, Donya Abu Sitta, reporting from Khan Yunis. Meanwhile, my colleague Ali Abunima reported this week that Palestinians from Gaza, recently released from Israeli detention, have given harrowing descriptions of sexual torture by their Israeli captors. He writes, quote, victims described rapes by groups of soldiers, forced stripping, forced filming, and sexual assaults and rapes using objects and dogs. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights, which collected the testimonies in recent weeks, said they reflect a systematic policy as part of Israel's genocide, rather than isolated incidents. Thousands of Palestinians are still in detention camps and prisons to which international monitors, including the Red Cross, have no access. These detainees were arrested solely for being residents of the Gaza Strip as part of a policy of collective punishment designed to humiliate Palestinians and inflict maximum psychological and physical harm on them, PCHR said. The group published harrowing, detailed testimonies of four victims, which I will not read here. In May, PCHR published a detailed report based on the accounts of 100 former detainees documenting brutal physical and psychological torture. For more, read Ali Abonnema's report, Palestinians Recount Gang Rapes by Israeli Soldiers, Dogs, on electronicintifada.net. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces carried out attacks in the village of Beit Omar, north of Al-Khalil, or Hebron, on Tuesday and Wednesday. The Wafa news agency reported that Israeli occupation forces enforced a full curfew on Tuesday after declaring the area a closed military zone. Middle East Monitor said that the Israeli siege was imposed hours, quote, after an Israeli settler was killed and three others were wounded, one critically, in a ramming and stabbing attack at the Gush Etzion settlement junction in the southern West Bank. The attack was carried out by two Palestinians, one of them from Beit Omar, who were shot dead by Israeli forces. Mohammed Awad, a local media activist, told Wafa news agency that the army prevented residents, ambulance crews, and other vehicles from moving within the town. According to Awad, Israeli soldiers took over more than 15 homes in several neighborhoods, positioning snipers on rooftops. The army also intensified their patrols, particularly inside the town center, where they prevented worshippers from reaching the mosques. At dawn, the Israeli army carried out a large-scale arrest campaign, detaining around 150 residents. The detainees were taken to a local school, where they were held and interrogated before being released hours later. Israeli soldiers also continued to enforce tight restrictions on all roads leading to the city of Al-Khalil, as well as on several of its surrounding towns and refugee camps. This comes after the army shot at residents in the northern town of Tulkarem on Tuesday during a demonstration where Palestinians demanded the right to return to their homes in the Nur Shams refugee camp. Israeli forces have imposed a 10-month-long siege on the camp. Al Jazeera cameraman Fadi Yassin was shot and injured by Israeli forces while covering the protest. Yassin said that after the residents were displaced 10 months ago, quote, "The refugees feel let down by everyone." He said he had been standing to the side of the protest, filming with a colleague before going for some interviews. Quote, "A soldier was shooting in the air. He then aimed for my legs. The bullet entered my left leg and exited my right." A 12-year-old child was reportedly also shot and injured, leaving shrapnel in his neck. Al Jazeera said that the army renewed the closure of the camp and barred anyone from entering. Other invasions by the Israeli army were reported in Hizma, Qalqilya, and Al-Luban al-Sharqiya in the recent days. Meanwhile, Israeli settlers burned a house and vehicles and injured a number of Palestinians in the town of Sa'ir in the southern West Bank on Monday. Wafa news agency said that the settlers assaulted Palestinians with batons and sharp objects under the protection of Israeli soldiers, who blocked fire engines and ambulances from reaching the area. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Israel Killed Their Four Children by Ahmad Sbeh, writing from Gaza. Iman al-Husari, 21, refused to leave her home in Gaza City's Beach refugee camp when the Israeli army dropped evacuation leaflets in early September. "I would tell her to at least pack our backpacks and be ready in case of an emergency," Amal al-Husari, Iman's mother, told the Electronic Intifada. Iman would reply that she won't even leave her room. Having failed before in October 2023 and 2024, Israel was preparing yet again to invade and occupy Gaza City and had ordered all the city's residents to evacuate south. Iman's brothers, Fuad, Osama, and Bilal, were also resolute in rejecting the Israeli military's orders. "Not one of my children agreed to the idea of evacuating," Amal, 50, said. The children's determination mirrored that of their parents. Amal and her husband, Mohammed al-Husari, 55, a taxi driver, were also determined to remain in their home in the camp. None of them wanted to again experience what Mohammed described as the suffering of displacement. In early October 2023, when the Israeli army first ordered all of the northern Gaza Strip emptied, the family packed only a small bag and evacuated to Rafah in the south. That winter, water leaked into the tent, and the family felt constantly cold. By contrast, the scorching heat in summer, Mohammed said, would force them to spend most of the day out of the tent. "We evacuated only with our summer clothes," Amel said. "We thought it would be a week or so before we could return. But the family's displacement stretched into a year and 4 months before they could return following the two-month January ceasefire this year." Around 2:30 a.m. on September 9th, Mohammed was jolted awake to the sound of a very loud explosion. It took a minute for him to realize he was under rubble, and for a moment he thought it was Judgment Day, he said. "There was fire, the heat was scorching, and the room filled with smoke. I couldn't see anyone," Mohammed told the Electronic Intifada. "I screamed for Amal. She replied, 'I'm under your legs.' I told Amal that I thought the children were martyred." The civil defense team came a short while later to look for survivors. Mohammed cried out for them while pounding on the concrete around him, he said. "Every minute, every second you remain under the rubble feels like dying a million times," he said. "There is no air, no oxygen, and you just want to die." Mohammed was rescued with injuries to his legs and back while Amal was pulled out unharmed. The two were taken to Al-Ahli Arab Hospital. Hours later, at the hospital, a relative told Mohammed that some neighbors heard voices and that Iman and Osama were alive, but that rescue workers were still not able to pull them out. "I prayed that at least one of my children survived," he said, by now crying freely. It was pitch black when the bombing happened, and civil defense crews lacked the equipment needed to search or dig through the debris. They could not continue and had to return in the morning. By the time they came back, Amal said, if the children had still been alive, they would have already passed away. 10 other people from the wider Al-Husari family were killed that day, Mohammed's brothers and cousins. When the Israeli forces ordered civilians to flee south in early September, Fuad, like his siblings, told his mother that this time he would not leave home again. He didn't. He is still lying beneath the rubble of their house, beside his two younger brothers. It has still not been possible to retrieve the 3 bodies. Those are excerpts from Israel Killed Their 4 Children by Ahmed Sabeh, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza and around the world. Social media user Mahmoud Masri witnessed a wedding party in the streets on November 11th, saying, quote, "It's wonderful to see a wedding in Gaza for the first time in 2 years. Seeing my people happy again is truly heartwarming." And across Palestine, high school students celebrated the passing of their graduation exams, known as Tawjihi. In the Rifat al-Arir displacement camp, graduates were honored last week. The Samir Project, a mutual aid organization, stated that, quote, "Takroj al-Tawjihi is a big deal in Palestine, let alone when you study and graduate during a genocide. From no lights in the evening to bad internet, students in Gaza did the impossible to finish their high school degrees." The Rifat al-Arir camp is no different from other camps in Gaza today with the Tawjihi celebrations. Tears of joy and sweet distributions when the students got their grades, but also remembering and dedicating this moment of joy to our martyrs. The celebration is a reminder of hope, of a future for these young men and women, dreams of going to university and being a part of rebuilding Gaza in a liberated Palestine. One day we will get there, the Samir Project added. And our contributor, Asim Al-Nabih, who is the spokesperson for the Gaza municipality and a new correspondent for Al Arabi TV, Asim says, quote, 3 months ago, I wrote an article about my sister Nesma titled What My Sister Teaches Me About Survival. That story was published on the Electronic Intifada in September. Asim wrote that, quote, over the past 2 years, Nesma has studied without the basic conditions that any student needs to succeed. Yet she presses on, teaching herself, helping younger children in the family to read and write, telling them bedtime stories, and refusing to let the genocide erase her future. This determination is not just resilience, it is resistance. Israel has tried to erase every element of normal life, cutting electricity, bombing schools and universities, killing teachers and students alike. Yet, like Nesma, thousands of children continue to learn, defying the logic of war that seeks to break their spirit. In this context, studying is a revolutionary act, Asim wrote. And on November 13th, Asim posted to social media that, quote, today her exam results were released. She scored 99.4%, ranking first in Gaza City. She has survived five wars and a genocide and still emerged at the very top. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.